is Upfront on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you for joining us today. Analysts say that there has been a rising interest by Americans, specifically the Black American community and the broader African diaspora, about news and issues related to Africa. They say that this interest is spurred in part by the global popularity of African culture. My next guest says that the international success of Afrobeats music, Nollywood films, and African fashion has played a role in reshaping narratives and strengthening these connections. Eden Harris, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist, tells me that culture continues to serve as the bridge to shared identities, social justice issues, and economic opportunities that can be leveraged to uplift both communities.
Well, I was a full-time national politics producer, and in that position, I noticed that I was among few journalists who were actually sharing stories on Africa, whether positive or whether negative. I wanted there to truly be diversity and inclusion and equity in storytelling in America. And because I was working for a network that was able to reach across the U.S., I wanted to use my position as a digital producer to share those stories so Africa isn't left and no one is knowing like what's happening on the continent.
Right. Now, there has been obviously this increased interest among African Americans or Black Americans here in the U.S. In learning about their ancestral roots, especially from Africa. What do you believe is driving this surge in interest?
Yeah, so I recently spoke to Dr. Page, who is the co-founder of African Ancestry, and she tells me people just have a thirst to know who they are. And a lot of that can be attributed to the social justice movement during George Floyd, when the entire world knew what was going on, and when the U.S. basically turned to learn how we can have African Americans and anyone who is of color feeling a sense of belonging in workplaces in America. And that was pretty much like the big genesis of people wanting to learn about who they are and where they come from.
Now, I know you and I first met at a cultural festival, the Ghana Festival here in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about some of the ways that African Americans are engaging with African culture today, again, through music, through art, through travel. What impact do you believe this has on their sense of identity?
Yeah, so what we are seeing is a cultural awakening, which is birthing a renewed focus on racial identity. And that is mainly because of Afrobeats. You have big artists like DeVito, Burna Boy, even Amapiano, big stars like Uncle Waffles, who are making the culture seem so appeasing and fun. And behind that storytelling that they're doing in song, you see happiness, you see joy. And I spoke to a few people who basically tell me that growing up in America, it was not cool to be African. Like, people had to hide their identities, their food. And now with the rise of Afrobeats, people are more into learning
more
about their, just more pride about where they come from and actually like where they're going, because they're embracing it. So that's something I'm seeing in my reporting, and that's something that my sources are telling me as
Absolutely.
It relates to it.
Have you done your DNA yet? Because that's the thing that is, I've seen many people do to try and, you know, figure out their connection to the motherland. How do you see this rise in DNA testing and other digital platforms influencing African Americans' ability to trace their ancestral roots and connect to their African culture?
Yeah, it's a booming business. You have 23andMe, you have African Ancestry and other DNA business models that are out there, and they're pretty much just feeding on that thirst of folks wanting to know where they come from. And as I just mentioned, like, it's that identity seeking, like wanting to know who they are and why. And that just helps people feel more at one with who they are again, and just feeling a sense of purpose and like why they are here.
Now, there's again a strong focus on culture in this reconnection journey, if we might call it, but what other aspects, either language or traditional customs, do you think African-Americans are also exploring?
Yeah, and not just African-Americans. I'm actually happy to mention that you have Nicki Minaj, who is teasing Afrobeats music, and she recently released a tweet speaking pidgin, and I was pretty excited and like surprised to see, because like we're all African diaspora. Like Nicki's from Trinidad Tobago, but she also has been an ally to Nyjah for quite some time, and to see what she may be putting out and speaking in pidgin is just like a sign that people are just are embracing languages across the diaspora and the continent.
Aden Harris, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today. What are you working on? What are some of your recent articles that people should be looking at, and where can they find your works?
Yeah, so I am a freelancer. I work for a lot of folks, Semaphore Africa. I write for a local paper called The Washington Informer, and soon Connecting Africa, covering technology issues. But I'm all things Africa, African culture, African politics. You know, my background's in politics. But there's a particular piece that I recently worked on, just basically in Washington, D.C. There is rhetoric from the far right that has prompted the Nigerian Center to cancel its non-citizen voting education classes on Wednesday. And that center...
The Nigerian Center where?
In Washington, D.C.
Here
in Washington, D.C. And that and the center's executive director, Benga Ogunjimi, tells me that Trump's recent false claims on Haitian immigrants saying that they're eating cats and eating dogs in Springfield, Ohio, is having a chilling effect on democracy. I was able to get some numbers from that NGO, and they said that on average, they are used to seeing upward of 100 registrants. But this time around, it was only 2.
Before you go, have you seen more African candidates, or I guess Africans in the diaspora candidates, running in this election cycle than previously?
So I don't have that data in front of me. I can only...
Have you interviewed any?
Have I? Yes, I have. Yeah. I have interviewed a few people. And also there's a local U.S. representative named Oye Owolewa, who is pretty active in the D.C. area. And, you know, he responded to the Nigerian Center class has been canceled. And he basically said, quote, you know, that's a reason why we need to get out there and share information, because if we aren't having these conversations, then we are allowing bad actors and liars and folks who are not telling the truth, or folks who may know the truth, to steer our communities in the wrong way.
Yeah, absolutely. And people like yourself, writers like yourself, are helping debunk some of this myth and stereotypes and stigma by writing and creating these connections between Africa and African Americans. And thank you so much for your work.
Thanks for having me, Jackson.
That was Aden Harris, a Washington, D.C. based journalist. She joined me here in studio at the Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? You are listening to Upfront on the Voice of America.
When you look at the cost that we get this education at, it is very alarming. For example, me as a student, the amount of money we pay is always very high, and the parents are always complaining about the tuition, because it's too expensive and high for them. And, you know, it's not good for me, because first of all, the books we need at university are very expensive themselves. We get these we have to buy them by our own selves, and this means that on top of the tuition which you pay, which is very high, we are buying textbooks. Now, this is a very burden on my parent.
Education is expensive because as of now, people paying a lot of money. For example, in some of the secondary schools, they are saying that this coming January, the fees will raise and will come in 12,000. So the people, they cannot afford to pay such kind of money.
For instance, last year, examination fee we were paying 2,700, but now it has been raised to 6,000, which is just showing that education is now expensive.
Very soon, all the problems of your nation. We want a revolution. Young people, revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education.
Hello. I'm enjoying your program. I'm Richard Martin Smolki from Nigeria, Taraba State, Gembu, Southern Local Government. Thank you very much.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you for joining us. In the past 6 years, Nigerian award-winning investigative journalist Philip Obagi has uncovered human rights abuses by Russian paramilitaries in West and Central Africa. Despite facing personal danger, including being held hostage and tortured by Central African Republic rebels and soldiers, Obagi has relentlessly investigated massacres, rape, and oppression by mercenaries from the Wagner Group and its successor, the Africa Corps. He was recently in the U.S. to testify at the hearing at the U.S. Congress. He joins me in studio and tells me that he initially got interested in the story when he started investigating the death of three Russian journalists in the Central African Republic. Philip, thank you so much for joining us today here at the Voice of America. You're doing the hard work in the Central African Republic, in Mali, documenting atrocities, human rights abuses. In the last 6 years, you've documented abuses in places like, again, Mali and Central African Republic. I want to start off by asking you, what drew you to this type of dangerous work? can you share some of the most, disturbing patterns that you have uncovered of these groups, paramilitary groups?
Well, let me start with explaining what drew me into investigating the operations and the atrocities of the Russian Wagner Group. So in 2018, three Russian journalists traveled to the Central African Republic. They were going to look into the operations of the Wagner Group, which at the time was new in the country. But unfortunately for them, in the central part of the CAR, they were killed. And even till this
day. I remember that incident. Yes. Yeah.
And my editor at the time, Christopher Dickey, at the Daily Beast, reached out to me and said, Philip, we want you to find out what happened, in the build-up to the attacks on this journalist. And I went close to the Central African Republic, went to Cameroon, tried to get into the country. It was difficult, but I still was able to ask questions, making phone calls, and I kind of had people tell me a little bit about where this journalist had gone to and exactly what the mission was exactly. So something struck me. I realized that they were not just going to confirm whether or not the Wagner Group was active in the country. They were going to look into every single operation that Wagner was doing in the country. Mm. And I wanted to continue from where they stopped. So that's why I began to focus.
That's why you started.
Yeah, that's how I started to focus.
Yeah, exactly. What they couldn't, journalists, and kind of finishing up the work.
What they couldn't complete, I wanted to finish.
Yeah. Were you worried that the same fate was awaiting? I mean, that's pretty ballsy.
Well, at the time, I thought since I looked like the local Central Africans, no one will be worried about me.
Yeah.
But maybe I was wrong. Yeah, I was wrong.
Where are you originally from?
Nigeria, okay. And I'm based in Abuja.
Okay, you don't sound Nigerian, by the way. We're talking about accents earlier.
No, I hear that
the
a lot.
The name is very Nigerian, but the accent is not Nigerian.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about these paramilitary groups, the Wagner Group, and subsequent group called the Africa Corps. What has been their role in shaping the political and military landscape of the CAR, and now in Mali, as we know, that they're operating in this in this country?
Well, they do a lot in the Central African Republic, much more than they do anywhere else in Africa. And before they came to the Central African Republic in 2017, much of the country was in the hands of rebels and militia groups that were seeking to overthrow government. So what Wagner has done that may be beneficial to the government is the fact that they've been able to keep Bangui, the capital, safe from these rebels and militia men. So they have they've been able to put themselves in very critical positions in government. the national security advisor to the president of the Central African Republic is a Russian. The communications advisor is a Russian. So you have Russian paramilitaries from the Wagner group, you know, everywhere in the country, manning some very important facilities, including gold and diamond mines. And you have Russian instructors, so-called Russian instructors, training the military in the Central African Republic. So pretty much what they do is, you know, provide security for government and train local forces, but also, you know, they are the police themselves in many places.
Mm.
Yeah.
They were invited by the government.
Of course.
Okay. I guess one of the if initially when I was asking you about the question is, well, what are some of the things that you've uncovered in, you know, the atrocities they have committed over the years?
Yeah.
Some of the...
Quite a lot. Mm. So their interest is in the gold and diamond resources in the country. And these resources are, you know, scattered around the country, particularly in the northwest and in the northeast. And what the Russians want to do is to completely control these resources. The problem they face is that before they came into the country, these mines were under the control of the rebels and in some places, you know, Christian militias. So to take control of these mines, they've had to fight. And they go into communities, open fire at the local people. They torture artisanal miners, you know, women, girls.
Wait, so are they trying to scare away the people from these communities around the mine so they can take control of it? So
that's correct. Yeah. And they make no distinction between the rebels and the local people. Yes. So they believe that even the locals, you know, work closely with the rebels. So it's a way of scaring people away, as you put it, and also a way of, you know, creating fear. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's what basically has been happening.
Have you noticed any shifts in tactics or behavior of these mercenaries over the years, especially after this transition from the Wagner group to the Africa Corps now, as they're known?
Not at all. So I was in the Central African Republic in December, and I went to investigate reports, you know, of a massacre in a northwestern town called Koki. So it's still similar. What I heard and what I saw is still similar to previous massacres that happened, you know, in other parts of the Central African Republic. So in February 2022, there was a massacre in Aigbado, and Aigbado is in the north central part of the country. So the pattern is still the same. Russian forces or Russian paramilitaries going into Koki in the northwest and then opening fire at people. It's still similar to what Wagner did in Aigbado, in Yanga, and the other places where the Russians have committed, you know, grave human rights abuses and massacres.
What have been some of the major challenges for you to, you know, in reporting this story or reporting these abuses? Do you, you know, how do you gather information or evidence in this such a risky environment?
Well, it's been very tough, very challenging. Access is one of the biggest problems because you have the Russians everywhere and they don't want anybody covering what's going on there. So you have to go, you have to disguise to be able to assess. But even at that, it's not easy because when you speak to people, you know, potential, well, people who are victims and people who are eyewitnesses, somehow, you know, if you don't do it in a way that no one sees you, you get into trouble. Mm-hmm. I give you an example. In December, last December, when I went into Beloko is a border town in the Central African Republic on the border with Cameroon. So I had barely begun to interview anyone on the border. I was trying to speak to people who were fleeing conflict from the Central African Republic into Cameroon. And I had not even started talking to anyone when two Russian soldiers showed up from nowhere, accompanied by four Central African forces. And then they arrested me, you know, took me to a military base, detained me overnight. And, you know, I was lucky to be released.
And they questioned you, of course.
Of course they did. Yeah. They questioned me.
Did you identify yourself as a journalist?
Of course not.
Because that would be risky. You probably would have. Would
yeah.
Have
if I had
so
done so.
How did you know that you were in the area? Like, what kind of, you know, information gathering mechanisms do they have? Are they working with local populations?
That is very difficult to tell, you know. And the reason why I didn't fly from Nigeria to Bangui, the capital, was because I was told a couple of years back by some local recruits by the Wagner group that they had been given orders. This local recruit told me that they had been given orders by their Russian commanders that if they saw me anywhere in the country, they should arrest me or get me killed. So I knew that if I had flown to Bangui, you know, that may have happened. So I decided to go by route from Nigeria, you know, to the Central African Republic. I don't know how they knew that, you know, I was a reporter. I want to believe, you know, they saw me, you know, looking a little different from the locals. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, maybe I had a big head, round face. That's not the way that, you know,
me.
Apparently, yeah, with a different accent. So they probably thought this.
Do you speak French?
My French is not so good.
Okay, so,
oftentimes, yeah, there was someone with me. You know, was.
You
because even the local people, some of them don't understand French that well. So I still need, you know,
a translator.
Yeah, for the local language.
Yeah.
So I think this thing gave me away. You know, my looks.
It's very difficult to disguise yourself. I have been in places in Africa, in South America, where people have called me out and like, you don't look like you're from around here.
Yeah.
And this is in a very majority black population where, you know, I'm trying as best to dress down.
Of course.
You know,
so if I did see you in Nigeria, I will tell that you are not Nigerian.
Right.
Yeah.
So Central African Republic, now we know that they're in Mali, obviously, very openly in Mali. What are some of the things they're doing in Mali that are kind of similar to what they've done or they're doing in the Central African Republic?
Well, the elect
of operations and, you know, trying to acquire control of these resources.
They're not acting, you know, exactly the same way they do in the Central African Republic, being that they're not so embedded in government in Mali. In Mali, what they're doing is they're working closely with the Malian forces in fighting, you know, against jihadists in northern Mali. So we haven't seen anyone from Russia become a member of cabinet, you know, so to speak, or anyone
or
from
be
Russia.
Part of the forces that guard the president.
That's not happening in Mali.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're very active, you know, in the northern part of the country where they work with the Malian forces to try and fend off jihadists and the Tuareg rebels who are seeking independence, you know, for northern Mali. Yeah, but in terms of the way they operate in the battlefield, that's no different from what we've seen in the Central African Republic. In terms of the way they abuse the local population, that's no different. You know, we've seen the Russians and the Malians storm communities, open fire at people, and then kill many. I think the biggest massacre, you know, the Wagner Group has ever carried out in Africa, happened to be
in Mali,
yeah, so where over 500 people were killed in one community. So, yeah, the pattern is the same. The stories of rape, torture, and the rest is, you know, still happening in Mali the way it is.
I did ask you a little bit about tactics, changing tactics ever since we saw the transition from the Wagner Group to the Africa Corps. But would you say that, you know, ever since this, you know, the starting of the war in Ukraine, the death of Prigozhin, the former commander of the Wagner, that somehow their power has been degraded in any way or their influence has been degraded? Has there been any changes?
I haven't seen, you know, anything on the ground to suggest that much has changed. We still are seeing hundreds of Russian paramilitaries in the Central African Republic. We're still seeing the same pattern of abuses. We're still seeing the same massacres. The only thing that has changed is that the man who once commanded the group, or once, you know, oversaw the group, is no longer there. And then, you know, you have the Russian Ministry of Defense overseeing
directly
the operations. Yes.
Yeah.
But they have decided to keep the same brand name, Wagner, in Mali. They call themselves the African Corps in the Central African Republic. And the Bier Brigade, that's a unit in the Russian armed forces, is active in Burkina Faso. So in the way they behave, I haven't seen any change. By the way, the operational commanders of the Wagner Group in the Central African Republic under Prigozhin are still the same people there.
Same people.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just a little different branding. Are there any signs of resistance from the villagers, for example, in the Central African Republic, fighting against these groups?
Well, some villagers, you know, happened to work with closely with the rebels and the militia groups that are taking on, the Central African Forces, who obviously are fighting closely with Wagner.
The Seleka, is that the term?
Yeah, yeah. The Seleka used to be a rebel group that, you know, fought the civil war in the beginning, but they've been disbanded now.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's still elements of the Seleka that are part of the other, the new rebel groups.
The new iteration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the Northwest, there's a group called the Union for Peace.
Okay.
Yeah, many of these members have, you know, are people
Selecas.
Who have come from old Seleka and what
gotcha.
Have you. Yeah, so that's still happening in terms of the locals coming together, some of them coming together to fight against the Russians. But the Russians, what they've been doing of late is they offer incentives to these local fighters, you know, offering to recruit them into the Wagner fold if they are willing to lay down their arms, and even offering to send them to Moscow on training. We've seen, you know,
Ukraine, yes.
Of course, we've seen, you know, hundreds of locals who joined the Wagner group and who went to Ukraine's Donbass region to fight in the war.
But let me ask you this before we end our conversation. In terms of your reporting and the impact that you want to see it have around the world, what message do you hope that, you know, the stories that you do send to the international community, and what steps do you think the, you know, global leaders, including here in the U.S., take to address these human rights abuses?
I'm hoping that, first of all, that they recognize that a lot of people back in Africa, in Western Central Africa particularly, are facing danger, that people's rights are being abused, and that governments are falling in West Africa partly because, you know, Russia has also been spreading disinformation in ways that, you know, is swaying a lot of people to believe that, you know, democracy is no longer
a viable option
or a viable platform, you know, for people to live under governance. So that is growing. And we're seeing in West Africa how many countries are falling into military dictatorship. We're seeing even in Anglophone West Africa that some people are beginning to ask for some bit of a change in governance. So most of these things are fueled by the Russian disinformation. So there must be some effort to counter these narratives, you know, that people, journalists, are able to fact check what is being put out there by the Russians, and that people are bold enough, you know, to say, well, enough is enough, what you're doing is not right, and things must be done differently. But we need, you know, help from everywhere. Africans need help from the West. They need help from anyone who can.
From internally in Africa.
Yeah, but from
their leaders that they elect to.
But from home and abroad,
yeah.
You know, because this is an organized scheme. You know, what the Russians are doing is much bigger than what many people
and
know.
Quite effectively, as we've seen now.
Yeah, and they're not even spending too much money.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's working for them.
Absolutely. Phil, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today.
Thank you for having me, Jackson.
And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to you, our listeners, whether you tuned in on radio or via streaming platforms on our podcasts. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are at VOA Africa, VOA Upfront, and VOAAfrica.com. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Have a great week ahead, Africa.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here at Kalerwe Market, Uganda, Kampala, where in this whole market, women are crying out for their situations to change.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation each week right here on The Voice of America. Check your local TV listings.
Hello, I'm Vincent McCorry, Managing Editor of Africa 54 TV Show. In the U.S. election, vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz meet Tuesday for their first and only debate. And we will bring you the latest of Israel.